This next section now, presentation of experiences. Criteria used to analyze burning and restoration options. There are going to be three panels on the same topic. So we're running the same kind of cycle with the same focus three times. Once today, we first get here tomorrow, and then after lunch tomorrow. When the MAP work group put together desired outcomes and we started working on the agenda, it was the third desired outcome that they felt was really the most important that they want to spend the majority of the time hearing from you on. And that is, identify the most important criteria used by existing watershed-based planning tools or resources to analyze priorities and restoration options. I also have it up here. This is going to guide session one, session two, session three. Each of these sessions has three speakers who are going to give you a 20-minute presentation each, so an hour for three consecutive presentations followed by facilitated discussion. Each of the speakers who you will be hearing from, three in each of the panels and nine altogether, were given specific questions to address in the presentation. The first question they're asked to address is, what criteria did you use to analyze priorities and determine restoration options? How were the criteria developed, i.e. what information or data were used? And what tools were employed to compare the criteria? And as with the session we just finished up, after each of these presentations, there's going to be an hour for facilitated discussion. We'll set aside the first bit of time for just a Q&A, and then there'll be a facilitated exercise where we're focusing on a specific question. So session one will have three speakers, as we're about to get into right now, and then when we have a facilitated discussion, we're going to focus on the first question that we ask them to address. With the second panel of three speaks tomorrow morning, following that we'll have a facilitated discussion where we focus on the second question. And when the third panel speaks, I think after lunch tomorrow, we'll focus on the third question. Does that make sense, everyone? Yes, Sam?
It's just a quick question. Your first
question there. What criteria did you use to analyze generic priorities? Is that, could I put the word restoration?
Yeah.
So it could be restoration priorities and options.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. We have three speakers right now. Josh Collins, Kara Stallman, and Eric Wald. Josh Collins is a landscape ecologist and regional ecological planner with expertise in wetland evolution, geomorphology, and plant-animal interactions with the San Francisco Estuary Institute. Since joining the institute in 1993, Josh has been the lead scientist for the Bay Area Regional Wetland Ecosystem Goals Project, the Bay Area Wetlands Regional Monitoring Plan, the Bay Area Watershed Science Approach, and the Bay Area Ecosystem Analysis Information System, all of which I'm sure have very nifty acronyms. Kara Stallman has been working for the Baldwin County Commission since June of 2000, where she has spearheaded local watershed protection efforts in a fast-growing coastal county, as we've heard particular challenges she's facing. And Eric Wald is a wetlands program supervisor for the city of Eugene, Oregon. He works with partner agencies in the West Eugene Wetlands Partnership to manage 3,000 acres of protected wetlands and associated uplands in the region. I turn over to the three of them for the next hour, and then we'll have a Q&A followed by the associated discussion, which will focus on that first question.
Okay. Good afternoon. I so enjoyed the last discussion that I just give more time over to that, like my time. But I enjoy talking about this project, too. And I get to talk about something that worked. It was a success in the minds of most people that were involved in it, and even those that have learned about it since then. If you don't know about the Goals Project, you can get the report offline. If you travel west of the Mississippi, you start hearing about it more and more. If you get over to Sierra Nevada, it's on everybody's shelves, and it's getting used quite a bit. And it really is only focusing on the first or second question. I'm not sure where we are in our steps right now, but it talks about establishing goals and objectives. And I'm going to talk about how we went about doing that at a regional scale. I've gone back through and tried to adjust some of the terminology in the last 15 minutes in the PowerPoint to see if I can capture the language being used here rather than introducing yet more terminology. I'll even talk to that point briefly. Well, I didn't do this alone, obviously, and these were three champions at the regional level: Carl Wilcox from Fish and Game, State Department of Fish and Game; I put in region 3 there because we've been using the word region. This is obviously not an ecoregion. This is another kind of a region. Peggy Olofsson of the Water Board and Mike Monroe of EPA Region 9. Region 9 and Region 3 don't even look the same. You see them on a map.
And they're regional
water quality. Yeah, right. I should have said that too. Which is a smaller region. They're kind of nested, but anyway. You know, we have state and federal and local people involved in this and sharing equal responsibility. One of the things that's entertaining about the Bay Area, to get a meeting like this, is just nothing but horizontal structure and organization. Through most of these efforts, there's no hierarchy. You don't find out who works for whom and how much money they make. They show up at the table and they all have equal weight and voting and everything else. So we're very good about not knowing where they came from and what they're really supposed to be doing, but what they can do at that point in time to move things along. And we don't worry about what happens tomorrow. Well, there are 3 steps to regional conservation from our perspective. I'm not sure how much of this will be transferable to anybody else in this room, but it worked for us for about 5 or 6 years and seems to still be working. One is to set quantitative regional goals. The word quantitative is very important. You have to actually bite the bullet and say, how much of what do we want where? Literally, on a map, at some scale. So the trade-offs become explicit, because there's always trade-offs. What do we want? We put that off. The more people fumble around looking for seams and creases to work instead of making the hard decisions. How much of what kinds of habitat are needed where and why? The scientific and engineering answers must relate directly to management issues that are clear and dominant. Bob, I think that's what you were saying. Somehow those issues and those objectives of managers have to be right up there on top. So you're addressing something so it's relevant. The effort has to be relevant. 2, adjust the policies and programs and projects as tools to achieve the goals. Managers must be willing and able to change how they work and what they do. This is a tough thing. It's tough within one agency. It's certainly tough across agencies. And when we put people together in a room from different agencies and ask them to all start working together, one of the first things they start thinking about, you start thinking about, is budget, defensive budget. How much of this am I giving away? Does coordination cost me somehow? Is there cost savings? Whose cost savings is it going to be? These are very important issues. And so managers have to be willing to adjust the way they do things and sometimes even giving up part of the money that they have for doing things. But this is where mitigation comes in terms of policies. Can we turn mitigation into a tool for achieving the goals that we set together? Has it become part of the toolbox? In the Bay Area, I can tell you that mitigation still is a bad word in the environmental community. Mitigation is the last thing you ever do. In fact, you should never have to do it at all. That's the way most of us feel in the Bay Area. So putting mitigation into the toolbox with restoration and enhancement and acquisition is a scary thing in the Bay Area. But at least this effort begins to show that it could be used that way. And finally, measure progress towards the goals and adjust the goals for new ideas. This is the feedback loop. All the way through, you're asking yourself, am I right? Am I stupid? Do I do something differently? Goals change. Data fuel adaptive management, and good data are very cost effective. This we found out. Once you have your goals and objectives, once you know how to achieve those in the most cost effective way, then you can identify what data you need. Data actually fuel adaptive management. Designing data management programs, decision trees, without moving data through it, is something that just goes on forever. But once you're moving data through the system, you can see outcomes. Decisions are either better or worse. Then you have some sense of what the value of the data really are. Turns out we need less data than we thought. Now, for this particular case, I thought it'd be fun for you to see, at least entertaining, maybe a little, to see where this kind of evolved from. I mean, why are we having a goals project? It wasn't EPA telling us to do this. It wasn't the Corps of Engineers saying, you guys should really get to goals at a watershed level. It was because we had really hard things happening in the Bay Area with strange arguments taking place. For example, every wetland could do everything for everybody all the time. The whole laundry list of functions. Every time I saw a proposal to do something with a wetland, it listed everything a wetland could possibly do, regardless of its position, location, size, color, anything else. And people were just signing off on it. Oh, it looks good to me. It must be a really important place because it's doing a lot of things. Control flooding, recharge aquifers, filter water and sediment, control erosion, feed people, provide recreation, look good, recover endangered species. And that's just the beginning, as you all know. We're getting away from that a little bit, but that was the argument only a few years ago. Every wetland is precious. Well, every square foot of every wetland is precious. There's no triage. Everything has to be saved for everybody all the time. This is where we were. You can imagine the train wrecks happening over permits and mitigation and, you know, where are the trade-offs going to happen? It wasn't a very pretty sight. Yeah. Fit for Molly. It's always clear to Molly. You're beginning to see that. She wants product. Well, this was the real crux of the issue, right? There are two main wetland types in the Bay Area. These two types account for about 85% of all the wetland acreage that we have. And they're mutually exclusive. You have tidal marsh and you have dike tidal marsh. That's what used to be marsh and isn't anymore. Well, I was on the federal recovery teams for two endangered species that only live in this. And the only way you get more of those species is by making more of this. And the only way you make more of this is by converting this into that. But unfortunately, this has been celebrated as habitat for migratory waterfowl and shorebirds. And so you had whole groups of agency people, dedicated staff, saving this. And another group of people trying to make more of this. This could either be the levee between the two or the hallway between the offices. It's basically the same thing. So we went back and said, what did it used to look like? Let's get some sense of common ground. In fact, the way we got in historical ecology was in a room like this with people on both sides of the levee representing those resources and trying to figure out, where's the common ground? What wasn't out there right now, that's for sure. And we kept going further and further back in time until we got to a place where really they shared the resource. It turned out to be about 1750. But so we go back to about 1750, and here's the high tide inside the Golden Gate before European contact, and here it is after European contact. Now, this is a lot of water, but you can see how much smaller it got. If I can go back. How do I do that? I'm so afraid of doing this. PU, that's a good, yeah. Thank you. Okay. Two thumbs, like my son playing games on my cell phone here. Does that work? Yeah, there we go. Okay, you get some sense of that. All right, so we can make it even more dramatic than that. This was the historical distribution of tidal marsh in color on a 10-meter node DEM. It's in different colors because each of those colors is a separate patch for the salt marsh song sparrow and the California salt marsh harvest mouse, two endangered or protected species. And based upon the rules we have for the way they move from patch to patch, what their barriers are in natural history, you come up with this picture of how many patches there were. It's about 200,000 acres of habitat for them, broken up into about 300 individual patches. If you go to the future, it looks like this. 40,000 acres and much more patches, but they're fewer and they're strangely shaped, as you can see. So past habitat for rails and song sparrows and mice, and present habitat for those things. So, oh, I'm sorry. It says after. Well, you caught on really quick. Yeah. It should say after. So that's the change that we've made. So you can see how people involved with tidal marshes are saying we have to get a lot more of those back. And because they're dealing with endangered species, they're kind of winning the day. So there are three competing views of this diked marsh. There were people who saw it as real estate. There was a real big effort to go out there. It's the flattest land we have in the Bay Area. It hasn't been developed yet, all this diked marsh. So let's build on it. So there was a whole bunch of rationale not to do that because of the importance of seasonal wetlands to waterfowl and shorebirds. And then there was the idea of seeing that as potential tidal marsh. And so you had development versus environment, kind of a classic problem there. And you also had migratory bird treaties versus the Endangered Species Act. You had that problem there. This goes on, the mitigation continues. We're still struggling with that whole issue of development versus environment. And this grew up to the holistic habitat goals in a watershed context. That's how to get these things resolved. Quite apart from saving the world, it was almost saving careers at that point. People were yelling at each other. So we sort of scaled up for the purposes of, one, going back in time to see what was a common reference condition for the debate, and two, scaling up in space so we could see both sides of the levee at the same time and bridge the gap between the offices. How do we do this? Assemble a team of environmental managers, scientists, and engineers. Find state and federal leadership to begin to transfer this from federal to state. And by the way, I keep reminding myself of things to say at this point. One of the really good things about this, at this level of project, is because their region, like Region 9 of EPA, is much bigger than the state regions. They have a broader perspective, dynamic staff in those large federal regions. Don't blink at some of these projects, where people who live in those projects day to day find them to be terribly, terribly stressful. So you bring in federal talent and federal perspective, sort of stretches out the stress a little bit, brings in a broader perspective and allows people to get along. Of course, you have to translate that down to state level, so you want both people co-leading if possible. Scientists need to be mindful of budgets and schedules. That's the other thing that always comes through a team that has to work well together. And managers need to give scientists time to think. So there's this tension all the time between science and policy, and you want to construct a group of people that make that work. Now, this is suddenly done on break, so it doesn't look quite as good as the other slides, but someplace up on top are bosses with purse strings. This might have been funny 10 years ago, but most of the bosses now carry purses. And so this is a big change in the distribution of gender within the hierarchy of these kinds of solutions. Down here you have dynamic staff, and by that I mean you have people, you know, moving up through the ranks of the agencies who have science in their background, they have a master's, maybe even a PhD. They understand policy, that's why they're advancing up through the ranks of their agency, but they're also project and permit managers. They know what that takes to get that done. So they understand this whole thing right there. They understand how the relationship between science and policy and practicality really operates. There are people moving through this all the time. And that's one of the problems with a project like this that takes 3 or 4 years, or any kind of a program we're talking about today, is staff turnover. You just get 4 or 5 people trained pretty well, and 2 of them disappear. You bring somebody else on with new ideas, and you either get resentful about that person or accommodate the ideas and change the whole paradigm. But people are moving through this. Below that are the people in the nuts and bolts with data. And I say science and engineering teams, but in our case, you know, this might be birds and plants and hydrogeomorphology and macroinvertebrates and small mammals and so forth. Those groups could be populated by landowners, by people from city government, by people from consulting firms. It's just whoever is best to work those particular teams. So you draw from the whole community of expertise. That doesn't mean PhD master's level. That means people who understand the way things work. A real challenge in a project of that kind of stakeholder involvement, that is bringing in people from all walks of life because they know something, is terminology. So one of the things that this group has to do is trust itself and trust each other to think out loud. You have to get to the point where people are just, as you were a few minutes ago, thinking out loud. The way that works is if they use the same lexicon, the same terminology. And my experience is that oftentimes you have to give up the science terminology and go to something more parochial to really involve the regional efforts in a big way. But this is a big part, thinking out loud together. Define the scope of the regional goals. That is, answer the question, what is the region? They have natural, social, and practical boundaries or definitions, and that's what Barbara was saying earlier. Define the big problem and envision the ideal solution. Make choices early on. What is the central problem in the region? It may be sediment supply, water supply, invasive species. What is one major stressor, major problem in a watershed of the region that you can begin to attack together? Don't try to do all the things. Don't solve all the problems. That's our experience. The problem of interest is the center of the practical ecosystem. Once you decide what you want to focus on, you can start hanging species onto it, hanging processes onto it. The ecosystem concept is wonderful, except you can't drive a car around it. You can't budget enough money in a year to figure out how to manage it. So at some point you have to decide, this is what I care about, and now I care about the things that affect that. And beyond that, I don't care anymore because I can't measure its effect upon the thing I'm trying to manage. So there's a practical aspect to ecosystem when you get in this kind of planning. So things that directly affect the problem are part of the solution. Other things lead to other problems. So don't go there. That takes a lot of discipline. Understand the environmental past, the present, and change. History can explain the present and help us forecast the future. There was some talk in the last discussion about the future, and I said, you know, don't go there, it costs a lot. Well, you have to go there. My experience, though, is that forecasting the future has so much uncertainty in it that other than sort of putting bounds around the possibilities, you can't really plan to go here or there. Right now in the Bay Area, our models for future changes in rainfall, both intensity within a storm and total amount during a year, vary by 300%. So where are we going to be? More reservoirs, fewer reservoirs, more frogs, less frogs? We don't know. So there's a lot of uncertainty about forecasting the future, but you have to get there. And it's a lot better to go back to the past and develop a data set from wherever you can than wait for 20 years until you've got one. So the idea is to go with what you've got, looking to the past. Also, as I said before, history is common ground. The history of a place unites the people who live there. I've yet to see this not happen. at the neighborhood level, the city level, the county level, the state level, the regional level. Once you get to a place where people are looking at their common history, they start talking the same language. Once they start doing that, they start defining the problem in the same similar way. It's amazing how you walk into a room where there's nothing but issue on the table, and nobody's bothered to see where it came from. If they go back together and discover the past and rebuild the future, they'll say, wow, look how we got here. And it's really nobody's fault. Everybody shares in the solution. Use everything anyone knows. Acknowledge what is known as fact, can be inferred from fact, or is mostly expert guesswork. Guesswork by experts is very, very useful. Usually, in our case at least, there weren't a lot of data. There weren't a lot of publications. I heard it mentioned earlier that some regions have more of that than others. We thought we had a lot. We had more gaps in information than we had information. So we went back to the authors of the information that did exist and said, what else do you know? And who do you know that knows something else? And began assembling people who, through career experience, could impart upon the project a wealth of knowledge and understanding. But we had to keep track of what is fact, you know, published literature, fact, what is gray, what can be inferred from fact, and where are we really just guessing? It's okay to think ecologically. People are afraid to do this. They want to get into constraints right away. They want to say, but we don't own that land. That person's going to sue us. Ah, forget it. Material cycle, energy flows across jurisdictional lines, fence lines, and even watershed boundaries. Think big. Play God. Draw lines on maps. I had one exercise with people about as many as we are here, and I put an outline of the Bay Area on a table to them, and I said, I gave them three colored crayons, literally. I said, don't cheat. Draw what you think the world should look like. And people could not even put crayon to paper. They were so concerned about the way this might happen. You know, turn off my microphone, close the shades, I might be able to do something. Eventually they broke that down. We hung them up on the wall. They might have all been drawn by the same person. And they went, I'm like, this is amazing. We almost have agreement already. So you have to just somehow pass the inhibition of not being able to think ecologically and come to terms. Visualize functions that account for the problem that needs to be solved. Okay, make the maps, present, needed, and future habitats as best as you could imagine them, because maps help us think well together about the land and life it should support. I find maps being the best coordination tool of all. Having that map up there means we all start thinking about that as watersheds. Once we have a map up there, we sort of organize people's thinking by what the map shows or doesn't show. Mapping the future makes goals real. And this is one of my favorite phrases, which is almost impossible to understand. You're asking about tools and the use of GIS. GIS makes zoom lens thinking out loud together possible. Well, Barbara was mentioning scales 1 to 6. We found that it's sort of an infinite number of scales depending on the functions you're looking at. If you have a GIS and you've built into it more data, that is more detail, more resolution, finer grain size than you think you might need, you can always zoom out. So in a room like this, we would have GIS on the wall and just zoom in and zoom out. Fly over here, zoom in and zoom out. Everybody then is time traveling and space traveling together, and you keep these very complicated concepts of space, time, and size, and ecological grain in the forefront of everybody's minds. And it keeps them thinking out loud about those very complicated ideas. So GIS makes zoom lens thinking out loud together possible. That's one of its best uses. In terms of analytical work, I think GIS has a way to go. But in terms of just illustration and coordination, very powerful tool. Have fun with conceptual models. Model what we know and don't know. Model what we can and can't manage. Try to separate natural history from human history. This one, what we can and can't manage, is a big deal. We have one case in the Bay Area where a team was able to separate sediment supply due to, or sediment yield from a watershed due to natural processes, sediment yield due to anthropogenic change, and then what they couldn't figure out. And it was about a 30-30-30 split. But that was the best we could do so far. Separating natural history from human history begins to tell you what you can and can't change. Very important. We have a basic conceptual model that I thought I'd put up there because it covers most of what, in a very coarse way, Barbara and Eric were talking about. You know, here's condition of the wetland in here, or function. I think there are some semantics involved between those two terms. Here it says condition. And it says that that's really the result of interrelations between sediment supply, water supply, as mediated by plants. So you've got these three things happening that control condition. But those supplies are governed by geology, climate, and land use. We explicitly put land use into this, put picture, people into the picture, because otherwise we keep neglecting them. Now, the circles could be different size and all of that, but, you know, hydrogeomorphology might be in here. You know, geohydrology might be in here. Okay. Very basic model. Practical points of view. I'm just going to throw these up there because they keep emerging as things we think we've learned. Ecosystems don't care, people do. It's a lot about people. All natural resources are actively managed or passively impacted to some extent. Knowledgeable people care, and caring people can change the world. I think that's actually true. The role of environmental science is to advance public debate, not solve all the answers, not give all the answers away, not draw conclusions, just get off top dead center to the next part of the debate until there's not enough data to get past that and get some more data and move a little further along in the debate. But it's just to advance the debate. Ecological health is a matter of culture, and culture is a lot more than science. Science is the easy part of the job, turns out, in regional conservation planning. Science needed to define alternative possibilities and forecast their likely consequences. So science is a big part of this, but it's arguably the easiest part. Plan for implementation before the goals are set. Focus on project performance in the context of ambient status and trends. Provide project design review to assure consistency with regional goals. That's one thing that wasn't on the list that we just looked at of steps, I think, is part of the details of that. But unless you have some kind of a committee like this to look at projects that come along that might be a part of the watershed, unless that group says this project fits or it doesn't fit, you can get all kinds of weird stuff happening in a watershed in the names of the watershed plan. So somebody has to oversee the design of those projects to make sure they fit with the plan and the approach that has also been designed. How will we measure progress? Inventory what we have, monitor how it's doing, assess government response. This is a really important one, and survey public sentiment. This gets left off a lot. And I've been in some meetings for months where people say, the public, you know, doesn't care about the frogs, they want flood control. We ask the public, they say, you know, we like the frogs. We can put up with some flood control. So it's really important to go back and get some sense of what the sentiment really is in the public. Lake mitigation projects to impacted sites and track net habitat changes. I understand from this meeting that some of that is going on in the country. We're not doing it in the Bay Area. So we're having a hard time tracking net changes. Molly wants me to do that, and I think together we're getting closer to it. We're getting there. We have this right now, which is the wetland tracker. I'm showing this because a couple of people here asked me to give an example of it. This is a website that does a very few things pretty well. It simply shows projects, restoration, and mitigation. And you can find out which is which, planned or completed. When you click on them, information pops up, and you can actually upload information from any computer in the world about a site. The thing that's kind of nice is that you can, as a base map, you can show the modern habitats, historical habitats, a topo, and now we're adding photography. And that seems to be one of the most influential things we've done in terms of outreach and education, is not get people to download this imaging, but allow them to toggle back and forth between past and present and photograph and to see themselves in that context. They really like doing that. Report frequently to the public. Everyone gets everything all the time. The internet makes this possible. Interim products, even incomplete answers, keep people interested. And public involvement builds public support. Okay, here we go. Last few slides. The criteria. I called friends and relations working on the project, and I said, give me the criteria. We struggled with this whole word. So I eventually just wrote down these things that I heard over the phone. The criteria to assess regional conservation plan. Is it relevant? Meaning, does it answer manager's questions? Does it answer Molly's questions? Have agency staff taken ownership? Very important. Are they going to use this thing? Is it just, literally as most things are, a report on the shelf, or is it on top of their desk? The goals project report is tattered with coffee stains on it. Most of the offices I go to, it gets used quite a bit because they took ownership of it, because they built it, because they were inside that triangle of dynamic staff, or they were a part of those focus teams. It involved over 100 scientists, loosely defined. Is it funded at least on 3 to 5 year cycles? Does it provide for early success? Got to get something to show the public early on in terms of success. And does it enjoy political goodwill? Does it get written about? Is it defensible? Does it reflect a consensus of scientific understanding? Now, this is a new term for us. Not opinion, but understanding. Not a consensus of data, or conclusion, but just more generally, is it fit the scientific gestalt of what things ought to be? Is it consistent with natural processes? Otherwise, we're going to manage this thing into financial oblivion. We will fail expensively. Is it sensitive to new understanding? Can we put up with staff coming into this process? Can we mentor the people somehow through this project? Is it sensitive to new ideas and new people? Is it more self-contained than subject to externalities? This gets back to scale and the regional definition. Are we working in a place where we don't have to deal too much with external forces on the system that are going to prevent it from being managed very well? Where does the water come from in the sediment supply especially? Will it be valuable tomorrow? Does it inform land use and major infrastructure changes? At the regional level, we have an opportunity to say, okay, you're going to rebuild all the roads. You're going to rebuild the highway. An important point here is that as much change as there has been in the last 200 years, there's going to be that much change again somehow. Every bridge we change, every hotel will be changed. Industries come and go. So what do we want to do with those opportunities? At the regional scale, we can work with Metropolitan Transportation Authority on road realignment, on bridge realignment, all kinds of things to achieve the goals and create opportunities for ourselves. We'll recover endangered species. Does it improve the efficacy of policies and programs? And does it evoke a sense of place and purpose for the public at large? How much of what kinds of habitat are needed where and why? With an expert mapper, regardless of jurisdictional property lines, that inspires caring community to turn public policies, programs, and projects into ways to achieve the goals. Okay, thank you.